Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Robin Clapp and me, Tony Gosling. Blink and you have missed it, but plans were announced this week to merge Bristol's two enormous NHS foundations. We tried to find out why, but I'm afraid without this week the help of the present leadership of the UHB, United Hospitals Bristol's Trust. Also, it's becoming increasingly clear that the people in charge of our oil industries and finance don't care much about the environment. So long as they can suck out the oil and invest in cheap ways to get energy to sell to us, then the government will let them do it, no matter what the cost to us, the wildlife or the planet generally. And also, Monday is Hiroshima Day. One day a year we remember the tens of thousands of Japanese killed by the world's first atomic bomb, which was used against a civilian population as opposed to a test. And I'm joined by a local peace campaigner and author on the subject of depleted uranium, Joanne Baker. Also, one very well-known critic of the official 9/11 story has just died this week. That's Gore Vidal. So let's have a listen to him a bit later, talking about the post-9/11 world in America, and particularly his book, Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. But we start this week with a discussion with Robin about world affairs. Now, Robin, just generally, I mean, we've got a bit of a tumult in the Middle East going on, and I just really wanted to get your take on what's going on with Iran and Syria, particularly because all around the Gulf and all around that area, we've got a lot of Western Navy ships just basically sitting there. There's a lot of threats to the Gulf of Hormuz from the Iranians and from us, basically saying that actually what the Iranians may do is cut off the oil supply to the West. Now, that's almost like a sort of artery of the West. We are completely hooked on oil, and if they did that, that would be a disaster. So what do you see as the sort of political context of what's going on in the Middle East right now?
Well, I think the visit to Britain earlier in the week by Mitt Romney indicated that the Republican Party leadership, or at least the section of leadership represented by him, have a very, very black and white attitude towards events in the Middle East. They believe that, you know, the first thing is the state of Israel is sacrosanct. The Palestinians' rights, a search for a just peace in Palestine, is very second down their agenda. In relation to Syria generally, it staggered me this week how little news there has been about the unfolding calamity in that country. Every news bulletin has led with the Olympics. The Olympics has been second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth and seventh stories. And then really a postscript has been the fact that the Assad regime is entering a new critical phase. There clearly is a civil war in Syria at the moment. Romney and others are ratcheting up the war talk by claiming that Iran is aiding the Assad regime. There is talk about the intervention of Al-Qaeda with the Free Syrian Army and so on. And of course, we've been here before. We've heard this bellicose talk from US spokespersons in the past. My own view at this stage is I don't think the Iranian leadership will do anything in terms of blocking the Straits of Hormuz in the immediate future. I think there is a pragmatic acknowledgement among the Iranian leadership that it would not be in their interest to see a situation where the US was felt to have no alternative than to intervene with airstrikes and so on. But far more likely, of course, is the possibility of Israeli strikes against Iran. There is a growing debate in the leadership in Israel about what to do in Iran. This is not a new debate. It's been going on for several years. Interestingly, many of the military, the more level-headed of the Israeli military recognize that it is not a sensible step forward to take. But, you know, there comes a time when the train leaves the station and events begin to roll out of control. And I think, dependent on the way that the situation unfolds in Syria over the next 2 or 3 weeks, we could be in an extremely grave situation.
Well, one of the things which we've heard this week, maybe not massive on the national news bulletins, was the arrival, mysterious I suppose you could call it, arrival in the hands of the Free Syrian Army of anti-aircraft weapons, of ground-to-air missiles. This is something which actually, you know, kind of takes the thing up. First of all, Robin, where do you think these things might come from?
Well, that's a very interesting question, isn't it? I mean, the resignation from his position as peacemaker of Kofi Annan yesterday indicates his frustration at the stalemate on the Security Council. And clearly, with Russia and China continuing to use its veto against military action, then there is no likelihood in the short term of peace in Syria. I think.
So, do you think military intervention by the West might bring peace?
No, I don't think that is going to happen. I don't think it's something that they themselves contemplate. I think it's very easy through airstrikes to bomb strategic military installations, as they did in Iraq. It's far more difficult than to win the peace. And I don't think at this stage any sane politicians would in Britain or America actually seriously contemplate ratcheting up the danger in Syria through airstrikes.
But I mean, Turkey, for example, is a member of NATO, and we know now that quite a lot of the foreign fighters that have come in to help the Free Syrian Army are actually being equipped by the Turks in Turkey. So this is a whole other front, because there is a border between Syria and Turkey, and they're coming across the border from. Now, this may be seen by the Chinese and the Russians, possibly, as NATO actually actively participating in this civil war and helping to supply the Free Syrian Army, which is effectively a kind of al-Qaeda type group, which is, you know, the West for a decade has said al-Qaeda is the enemy, and now all of a sudden it appears, at least maybe this isn't happening, but it certainly appears as if they've changed their tune at NATO and they now are helping out al-Qaeda because al-Qaeda wants to topple Assad.
Well, I think the Free Syrian Army is a very disparate movement. I personally would not wish to label it an al-Qaeda group. I think there is a very complicated situation taking place in Syria. Clearly, the Assad regime in the past has been recently courted by the West. For a whole number of years, it was persona non gratis. But like the former regime in Libya, the West sought to bring Syria in from the cord. I think the situation in the last week, particularly the humanitarian crisis that is unfolding in Aleppo and also in the hinterland of Damascus, indicates that we are reaching a civil war. And it would be not the case, in my view, that a Free Syrian Army could be simply manipulated by and led by the forces of al-Qaeda. Clearly, those forces have come into Syria. Clearly, they are intervening, just as the Saudi and Kuwaiti and other Sunni forces are also seeking to give aid against the Assad regime, because, of course, Assad bases his support traditionally on the small Alawite sect in Syria, and in that sense has ruled through divide and rule and called cruelty for a number of decades.
Well, but one of the aspects to all this, of course, is if you look at the existing regime, Assad is married to a British woman. It's actually quite a sort of light touch form of Islam, whereas a lot of people are scratching their heads and wondering, well, hang on a minute, maybe any kind of regime that were to take over from Assad is likely to be much more hardline or extremist Islamic.
Well, that's quite possible. But of course, the thing that triggered this movement in Syria was the Arab Spring in Egypt and in Tunisia. And in Syria, I'm sure there are many hundreds of thousands of ordinary people who yearn for a world and a country in which they have say, in which they are not threatened by Assad's thugs, just as was the case in Egypt before the revolutionary movement there. But these are complicated questions, because What you don't appear to have in the Free Syrian Army is a unifying force with a clear idea and a program of what it wants to replace the Assad with. You have a very heterogeneous movement, and just as in the recent Egyptian elections, you saw the growth of the Muslim Brotherhood and the pushing back of the political secular forces that had been to the fore in the original
period.
Well,
to be fair, in Egypt, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood was very big there anyway. Didn't have any expression in the government.
But
anyway, can we just move on to... because one of the things I like to do here is... Press TV is the English language broadcasting service from Iran. It's now been banned in Britain by Ofcom over actually what is a rather trivial case of lying, or telling an untruth. At least that's the allegation. And I get rather irritated by that, because I know for a fact, you know, as everybody knows, in 2003, all of our channels in Britain were putting out the lie that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and yet they are continually allowed to broadcast. Anyway, I like to get different views from different parts of the world, particularly when there's a conflict in the offing. I think it's quite fascinating to see. And one of the programs that they have on Press TV, the Iranian channel, had a look at a report by an organisation called Global Exchange, which is examining one particular question, which is how much money from big companies in the United States is going into the US elections. This is one of the things we don't necessarily see here on the British TV, is the massive amount of billions of dollars that are going in lobbying and who that money's coming from. So let's have a listen now to the banned channel, Press TV, the Iranian English language channel, talking about lobbying in the US elections.
A new report by the human rights group Global Exchange shows that the lobbying business in Washington is booming. In fact, the study says that in the last 6 years, advocates from the financial, insurance, and real estate sector who want to influence the votes of U.S. lawmakers spent more than $4 billion to do just that. The financial, insurance, and real estate sector is closely followed in spending by the health sector that shelled out $4 billion in the same time frame. Energy and communication lobbies each spent $3 billion. The military defense lobby, scrambling for a piece of $700 billion in U.S. business, spent $2 billion to influence lawmakers. All of that money does not include what's being spent on super PACs to influence the U.S. presidential and congressional elections. That number is expected to hit $1 billion, setting a record for national election spending in America. No. Gary Anthony Ramsey, Press TV, New York.
Robin Clapp from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. I just did a little bit addition there. That's $15 billion being spent by American corporations in the run-up to the US elections. Is that democracy?
No, of course it isn't. Nobody lobbies on behalf of the ordinary man and woman in the street. Nobody lobbies on behalf of the young child that goes hungry at night in the richest country in the world.
It's certainly not a lot of money compared to the sort of $5 donations which are being made to the Democratic Party in the Barack Obama's campaign. You know, it does pale into insignificance. So, I mean, what are your thoughts about the US election looking ahead to the end of the year, the presidential election? Who's going to win?
The problem that Obama has, of course, is that the American economy has begun to slip back again. Fewer jobs have been created in the last month than were expected. The economy is still recovering from the 2008 housing crash, and I think that Romney is able, therefore, to score easy points in terms of saying that Obama hasn't put America back to work again. My own view is that Obama nevertheless will retain the presidency, because I think as the Democrat Party machine goes into overdrive and exposes the real Mitt Romney, it will become clear to many, many ordinary Americans who might think about voting for the Republicans that this is a multi-billionaire. This is a man who allegedly has no links with the company he helped to found and which made him a billionaire, but nevertheless refuses to reveal his tax returns over the last few years, because very probably they show that he has still had huge retainers from this company. So I think Obama will win the election.
Well, we'll see. Another aspect to all this is, which way is the military going to vote? And one person who's quite an interesting character on that Also on Press TV, you won't find him on British TV or radio pretty much anywhere else, is a guy called Gordon Duff. He's the editor of Veterans Today. So let's see what he has to say about the US elections and whether the military are going to be voting for Mitt Romney or Barack Obama.
I'm one of the people who used to write the intelligence analyses for the U.S. Senate and for the President of the United States. The problem is that President Obama is the most liberal and trustworthy person we have, and that his opposing candidate, by my impression, and I'm an intelligence industry professional, represents the most draconian forces, 1,000 times worse than Obama, is the representative of world drug dealing, organized crime, and Wall Street. And if anything, Obama, I have to admit, we all have to list a great number of sins and a great number of disappointments. Even people within the military are universally going to support Obama. Well, one of the biggest concerns I think all of us have is the formation of the Department of Homeland Security, and it brings to mind the German term Reich when they speak of homeland. It's certainly not a term any American uses. It's a duplication of powers that is expanded well beyond the legal checks and balances of our Constitution. Almost every one of these acts, almost every one of the things the military is trying to take on itself, is a violation of existing American laws.
That was the editor of the Veterans Today website. His name is Gordon Duff, and he was speaking on the English language Iranian channel Press TV, which is now banned in Britain. You're not allowed to watch it.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, Blinken, you'll have missed it, but plans were announced this week to merge Bristol's two enormous NHS foundations, the UHB, United Hospitals Bristol, and North Bristol Trusts, into one. Well, to discuss the merger, I'm joined by a patient advocate who's fast becoming our NHS correspondent, Daphne Havercroft. Hi, Daphne. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
OK. Now, how big financially are these trusts?
Well, a respected health journal has published some information about the merger, and according to it, the 2011-12 North Bristol turnover was about £519 million, and University Hospitals Bristol was around £491 million.
So we're looking at, I mean, this is an enormous spending, loads and loads of people obviously employed, much of that money going on wages to look after people in the city. Ultimately, do you think this is, how is this being motivated? What's your thoughts on it, Daphne?
Well, I think that the two trusts have talked about merging for a long time. And I think in principle, this is a personal view, they should have done it a long time ago, because they've been spending a lot of time reconfiguring health services across the city where they've got the same services in each hospital. But it's been bogged down by a lot of politics and messing around. So actually, I think in theory, it should be good from the patient point of view if they merge these services. But the proof of the pudding is how well they do it. And both trusts, in my view, don't have a very good track record on their governance procedures. So whether they can pull it off, we don't know.
Well, I invited the chairman of the United Hospitals Bristol Trust, John Savage, and any of his colleagues on tonight to explain the reasons for doing it, but I got no reply from the NHS Trust. When I phoned them yesterday and spoke to the Public Relations Officer, Laura Treasure, she explained the Director of Communications was Sarah Pinch, and that they had decided neither to put up anyone to speak about the merger nor to give a reason. That is our decision, is all she would say. Is this acceptable for a body which is supposed to be responsible for so much public money? And we're talking there, Daphne, about £500 million annually being spent.
No, I don't think it is, because I find that with both trusts, they are very reluctant to be held accountable to the public. And as you know, when I've been on the programme before, we've got the big old histopathology problems that have still not been resolved. And we've got a lot of questions about an inquiry that was held a few years ago, and they refused to answer them. But they are paid for by the public, and they have a duty to hold themselves to account to us and explain and answer our questions.
Well, it's a great pity that they haven't decided not to do that. But ultimately here, I mean, as a patient advocate, how accountable do you find the trusts, the two trusts? Because, I mean, this is really important, isn't it? So much money is being spent, public money, taxpayers' money being spent, especially in these tight times. As a patient advocate, how accessible do you find, their facts and figures? And, as someone that wants to find out what's going on, can you do that?
You can in their accounts. So any information they want you to have, it's quite easy to get hold of that. Information that you might want to have, and I'll give you an example, the two trusts, whether they merge or not, or before they decided to merge, were integrating their pathology services, and it's Bristol and Western who are doing that. Now, one of the things that I, as a potential user of those services, want to know is, if you integrate your services, how is it going to be better? Because a lot of it is being driven by cost cutting and efficiency savings. But the director, or the Department of Health's National Director of Pathology in 2010, said that any mergers and consolidation must not be at the expense of quality. So the questions I want to know are, well, what are your current quality standards? Where do you expect them to be after this merger? Because they should be going up, or at least staying the same. And when you ask those perfectly reasonable questions, you don't get any sensible answers out of them. And that is completely unacceptable, because the NHS Constitution says that members of the public and patients should be able to compare NHS services around the country. And that was driven from the BRI heart scandal, where the inquiry was published 11 years ago, that it was definitely the case people should be able to compare services, and we can't because they won't give us the information.
Okay, so as anyone that's actually interested in the healthcare, are there any, how do you find is the best way, if there are, ways that the public can literally personally scrutinise what's going on?
It's very difficult. One of the ways that we've tried is using the Freedom of Information Act, because if you ask them questions in meetings or you write to them and don't get answers, then in theory the law is on your side to be able to, it gives you the legal right to ask under the Freedom of Information Act. But even then, they won't answer the questions. So then you have to resort to raising a complaint with the Information Commissioner and waiting for the Information Commissioner to get round to getting a caseworker to look at it.
What about health scrutiny, though? Because we do have a City Council Health Committee, and we've got, at least supposedly, there is a sort of shadow committee to that, yeah, which scrutinises what the Health Committee is up to.
Yeah, now that's an interesting one, because we raise our concerns and our questions with both South Gloucestershire Health Scrutiny Committee and also Bristol. But there's some interesting things been going on in Bristol, because in January we went to see them and raised the unanswered questions we've got about the histopathology inquiry. And one of the councillors asked for that to be considered as emergency business. It was considered as emergency business at the end of that meeting. A number of councillors expressed concerns about the NHS attitude to responding to questions, and yet that emergency business was not minuted. And we have taken that up with Bristol City Council, and we have yet to receive a satisfactory response as to why emergency business conducted at a public meeting is not minuted.
Now, call me sceptical, but the implication there seems to be that there is almost an expectation that nobody's going to bother to turn up at these what might be otherwise boring meetings to actually scrutinise how this £500 million of public money is being spent every year.
Well, the councillors are supposed to represent us, the people, and ask the scrutiny questions. And if we have concerns, to be able to ask questions on our behalf. So, yes, really, to make sure questions are answered, it does really rely on people going along and telling their councillors, these are the questions that we want answered, either to write to them, ask to meet them, or come along to a health scrutiny meeting. Every meeting they have a public forum session where people can make a statement, members of the public make a statement or petition the councillors to ask questions.
Okay, well, there's been another development since I last saw you on the PFI front, which is a pretty disastrous one, and that is that, several trusts are being questioned as to whether they're actually viable because of the massive private finance initiative debts they've got. In fact, in South London, one trust has even had to go bankrupt. So, I mean, we've got a massive PFI going on right now at Southmead Hospital. Let's look into the future, Daphne, and gaze into the crystal ball if you can. Is this really stocking up problems for the future here in Bristol? Because it's all very well agreeing and signing these documents to get a new hospital built, but are we going to actually be able to pay for it, or is the trust going to go bust?
It all depends on what the business case is for this merger, and whether it really is a merger, or whether the University Hospitals Bristol, whether they are taking over North Bristol and having to somehow swallow the PFI debt, whether the Strategic Health Authority has some money that it is using to help oil the wheels, shall we say, and I don't know the answer to that, but it's some interesting questions that it raises.
But it's pretty shocking, isn't it, that something that has as important as an NHS trust can simply go bankrupt.
Yeah, that's right. And
Robin, you want to chip in there?
That's one of the issues of PFI, isn't it?
Well, I think that many of us in the anti-cuts movement and those of us on the left have for years been very, very worried about the entire concept of PFI. Not only have PFI schemes in the NHS cost between 2 and 3 times more than they would have cost had the investment come from the public sector and from government, but the accountability generally has continued to erode. And as you say, it seems absurd to be sitting here talking about an NHS trust being technically bankrupt because of PFI. I think there are enormous problems being stored up for the future. My concern about the comments that Daphne has made is that I can't believe that any discussion about bringing the two trusts together is not linked in some very intimate way to the question of cost cutting. And in a week when I've heard in some hospitals nurses are being now asked to clean wards because trusts are cutting back on cleaning contracts, I am fearful for the survival of the NHS in the form that, you know, I've been very grateful to be a beneficiary of in my years, and so for other people as well. But PFI in schools, in the NHS and everywhere else is really just another way of letting the private sector get their hands on big government contracts, and we, the taxpayer, the people we're always being told by the government come first, have to pay these bills for PFI enterprises for 50 or more years before we own these services. That's absurd. If we had had public investment in the first place, we'd own these services and thereby be able to have accountability from day
one
of the building programme.
We would not have a new hospital being built at Southmead if it wasn't for PFI, so surely we should be congratulating the North Bristol Trust.
I'm still not convinced about the reason for going down to 2 major hospitals from 3. I was an NHS campaigner for a number of years when I, along with many other people, failed to get adequate responses to questions we asked about the business case for closing Frenchay Hospital. Admittedly, these are questions that can't be reversed just by standing outside a hospital with a placard, but it's really important that the voice of opposition is heard to this idea that there's no alternative to PFI, because if PFI contracts are going south and hospitals are becoming bankrupt, then surely that's as serious an indicator of a failed economic policy as that of banks, which promised the world and now have gone belly up. We need a proper root and branch discussion about what sort of society we want in the 21st century.
Okay, Robin, thank you. And Daphne, to wind up, can you just give us an indication of your organisation? You run a sort of Southwest Action Group, don't you?
Yeah,
what is that, and where can we find it on the internet?
It's called the Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. And if people go into an internet search engine and type in SWWHAG, we'll come up. You can read our blog.
Lovely, thanks very much. Friends of the Earth in a minute, but first some music from Winifred Atwell, would you believe, from the 1950s. Well, they don't make them like that anymore. That's Winifred Atwell with 2 minutes of absolute mayhem, but brilliant bit of piano playing from her from the 1950s. Now, it's becoming increasingly clear people in charge of our oil industries and finance don't care much about the environment. Well, so long as they can suck the oil out of the ground and invest in cheap ways to get energy to sell to us, the government seems to be able to just simply let them do it, no matter what the cost to us, the wildlife or the planet. Well, at least there are some people trying to stop this rape of the planet, and one of them is David Powell from Friends of the Earth. Hi again, David. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, you often tout wind turbines as a great alternative to the traditional forms of energy, like coal and that sort of thing, but they do make actually quite a lot of noise if you live near them, and also they're usually stuck in the middle of the countryside, you know, sort of this is the place we're supposed to be looking after. We don't really want a giant tower and a wind turbine in the middle of the countryside, do we?
Well, firstly, I mean, yeah, well, let's talk about fracking then in that case, because I think fracking is well, we can talk about wind turbines in a second, but okay. The reason why that's relevant is I think a lot of the people who get upset about wind turbines haven't yet realised what fracking is going to bring. So fracking is, for those who don't know, stands for hydraulic fracturing. It's basically digging drilling a well down into the earth for a couple of kilometres, then going sideways. You then set off, you fill that well full of water and chemicals, you set off explosive charges, and you unlock gas that's tied up deep inside the earth, and you get that gas out.
Now, hang on a minute. In the old days, they used to just drill, like drilling for oil, and they'd find natural gas. So why can't they do that? Why do they have to pour all these chemicals into the ground?
It's running out, Tony. And we 10 years ago, we were not self-sufficient in gas, but we produced more than we needed to ship in. That's changing now. So the gas in the North Sea is in decline. So they're looking for other ways to get gas. And over in the USA, they've been doing this, what's called shale gas fracking, for a decade. And it's just really taken off over there. And a few people have looked around and thought, well, we can make some money here. And they're really trying to bring it over here. Now, you'll have heard in the news up in Blackpool, where they were doing this, it was causing earthquakes. And the company that was doing it said, oh, I'm sure that's not our fault. And, you know, surprise, surprise, an investigation said it was their fault. That's just the tip of the iceberg. They're wanting to do it up in the Mendips, up near where I live, and that's where the water that goes into Bristol, goes into Bath, goes into Weston-super-Mare, that's where that water all comes from. And there's a wonderful film called Gasland, which is an American film, where they show people being able to set fire to their tap water because of underwater gas leaking into underground gas leaking into the water system.
And this is after the frackers have been around.
This is after the frackers. Now, this is all about one thing and one thing only, which is refusing to change the way we think about energy in this country. We have we are hooked on fossil fuels. I know you were talking about it earlier, Tony. Absolutely hooked on fossil fuels. We do need a sea change in the way we generate our energy. People don't like the idea of wind turbines, although, to be honest, the opinion polls show the majority of people do.
Well, isn't it this usual NIMBY thing, that it's okay so long as there's not a wind turbine at the end of my back garden, especially if you're living in the countryside. You've paid hundreds of thousands of pounds for your nice house. You don't want to have it ruined with one of these great towers suddenly appearing.
Right. So there's a couple of things about that. And the first is, not everybody has a problem with them. I live in the countryside. I don't have a problem with them. But there is a problem with who owns them. Now, it's not surprising that people see these things going up, you know, on the hillsides, spoiling their view, and they don't see any benefit from them. Now, we want to see a wholesale change in the way that energy is generated, that energy is owned in this country, so that people actually take control of their energy and they get solar panels on their roofs and they get stakes in wind turbines that are in their local area. I think you'd see people being a lot more accepting of wind turbines if they thought it was actually doing something for their community.
Well, it's a kind of ownership thing, isn't it? If it's my wind turbine and it means that I'm not having to pay a massive electricity bill, the only thing is, of course, there's a bill to maintain the turbine.
Yeah, that's right. But what you're talking about is essentially free energy. So there is a bill to build the things.
Just a minute. Free energy, I don't believe you.
Well, free energy at the point of use. So you have to pay to build them. You have to pay to maintain them. But the alternative, the counterfactual, is fossil fuels. Now, if you look at what the price, anyone who's filled their car up over the last few years, you know what the price of oil is doing. Anyone who's paid their energy bill over the last few years, you know what your energy bills are doing. That's happening because there's more and more people wanting fossil fuels and because we haven't invested enough in the alternative. It brings us right back to fracking, Tony, because people are saying, well, crikey, where's the next wave of gas going to come from? Where can we get more gas from? So the big companies are homing in on the UK, they're homing in on the land and off the offshore areas. They're wanting to build these fracking wells. And the reports are that although it could be safe, there is absolutely no guarantee that it will be safe. And the government is refusing to wait until fracking can be shown to be safe before giving it the green light. They're desperate for more gas. They don't care about climate change, they don't care about the long-term implications, and they don't care about proper investment in the alternatives. That's what we want to see, and we want to see the government properly championing renewable energy and not just doing it on the side as well as lots more gas.
Now, I know there's a campaign out there called Frack Off, which is trying to take direct action in some cases to stop this. What can we do to stop these people pouring these chemicals into our watercourses? Because this is actual, you know, it sounds like a total disaster. I mean, the idea of turning on your tap and getting some fracking chemical out and or setting fire to your water because of what's going on, it just sounds appalling.
Yeah, there's huge problems with it. I mean, there's even if you're only using a small amount of chemicals, if you're pumping 4 million gallons of water into a well, which is what we're talking about, that's how much water you have to pump in to push the gas out, even if only 1% of that is chemicals, you know how much chemicals we're talking about. There's all sorts all over the country, there's all sorts of grassroots campaigns springing up. There's one in my doorstep, Frack Free Somerset, which is organising stuff specifically around the proposal to do drilling up in the Mendips. On the 22nd of September, there's an international day of action against fracking going on. It's called Global Frackdown, which I quite like. You can go to their website, globalfrackdown.org, and have a look what's going on. Tessa Munt, one of the local MPs, is really championing this. She's really upset about fracking on her doorstep. And I think people aren't, as soon as more and more people become aware of the risks of this, the fact that the government hasn't waited for the green light on this being done safely, and the fact that the government is just prepared to say, we think it's probably all right, therefore we'll go with it, I don't think people will be satisfied with that, not when they know what that can mean for their local areas.
Well, one of the positive things I've seen over the last few years with regards to energy is this whole business of all these solar panels popping up onto people's roofs. What's the latest with that? Because that was there was a rush of that, wasn't there, towards the end of the last government 2 years ago?
Yeah, that's right. So Friends of the Earth took the government to court three times and won three times, because what the government realised was that actually solar panels were a hell of a lot more popular than they thought they were going to be. And so all across the country people were putting them in, and the government said, oh, hang on a minute, we're not sure we can afford that, and they tried illegally to cut the subsidies. We took them to court and we won. The reason why people like solar panels is because they love the idea of generating their own energy, and you can see them, you know, again where I live, you see them on every other rooftop, you see them all over the place.
Well, that's partly because these massive oil firms and big energy companies, I mean, they're almost like cartels. They sit together, they sit round the table and they go, right, well, we're going to fix the oil price, and we're paying massive amounts of money for our oil, even though this is like sometimes up to 100 times the cost of actually extracting that oil from the ground.
Well, that's right. And look, last year, the average energy bill from British Gas went up by £200. That's everyone will remember the massive spike in energy bills. And it was reported last week that British Gas make £1,300 of profit a minute. An extraordinary amount of profit. They don't pass that profit back on.
Well, that used to, when it was before it was privatised, of course, that would have gone straight into the Treasury, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And I think people, you know, the energy companies are not liked, and people do not like the fact that they're over a barrel. Sure, you can change from one big six company to another, but unless you properly change who you're with, people love the idea of saying, wait a minute, why shouldn't I generate my own energy from the sun when it shines, or the wind, you know, which it does a lot more.
Well, we had a guy called Julian Parry from Somerset on here a few weeks ago, who has actually got in one of the local papers in Somerset, because he decided to change energy users to E.ON, and he found his first bill came through for several £1,000 for a quarter. And as it's a direct debit, of course, you've then got to get on the case to stop this money disappearing from your bank account.
I mean, you know, these are massive companies who monopoly is the wrong word, oligopoly is a better word. You know, you could, they've 99% of the UK use one of the big six energy companies. There are other energy companies out there. There's Good Energy, Ecotricity, Ove Energy are another one. Or, you know, and or you can start doing much more with solar panels. A really interesting thing you can do in your community is to start clubbing together and buy a wind turbine. You know, across the country there are organisations who putting their money together. You get £100,000 together in a community, you get small local wind turbines going up, everyone benefits. That's
I mean, is there anywhere around here that's actually happened, like a village, in a village where people have got together to start generating their own power?
Not sure about around here. I know there's springing up all over the country, particularly in the southeast. There's a lot of things going on. The government's actually doing, there is some money available for these organisations to get off the ground, but still, if you look at what you're actually looking at, comparing it with, you're comparing it with massive energy companies, you know, massive fossil fuel usage, massive infrastructure. So there's an awful lot further to go in that way, I think. But that's what we want to see. Doesn't everyone want to own their own energy? And, you know,
why is it, David, that Friends of the Earth seems to, so much of you spend much, so much of your time actually talking about energy and the where we get our power from? Why is that?
Well, 45% of the UK's carbon emissions just because of gas. You know, if you chuck on the 3/4 actually of our carbon emissions are directly because of the energy we use in some form or other in heating our buildings or homes or in the products we buy, and the rest of it is transport. I mean, we're not going to, we have legally binding climate change targets, but even if you don't accept the legally binding bit, we've got a climate change problem. The International Energy Agency, who for years and years were apologists for rich energy companies, have actually started to say, all right, hang on a minute, climate change is a bit of a problem. And they say we've got 5 years globally to peak and start declining our emissions. That's only 5 years, that's a handful of years. Every year global carbon emissions go up and up and up. And this isn't just something that's abstract anymore. Scientists have said for the first time that the vile weather that we've been having is because of climate change. Over here it's been raining constantly. Over in the US it's been record temperatures. You've had airplanes melting into the tarmac over there. This is now happening, and this is having real impacts on people around the world. And the people that will hit, really feel that impact the most, are people in the poorest country where they can't just spend money and get their way, you know.
Yeah, see, I mean, in a way, over the last, say, 20, 30 years, people have got used to very, very cheap energy. And so now they use, I mean, for example, long commuting distances, that sort of thing. So I suppose what Friends of the Earth are saying is we're going to have to change all that.
Yeah, well, people have got used to it for good reason, because it's been cheap. Our infrastructure has been built around it, you know, so energy is in every, we're so reliant on it. We need to use less energy, but we also need to think better about the way that we generate it. If we do both of those things, we're not talking about hair shirts, living in caves, no longer having to have tellies, you know. But we need to do it in the right way. And what we do need to do is get serious about it. And climate change isn't something that's happening tomorrow. It's happening now. And unless we really change our ways as a globe, not just as a country, but in everyone's home, in every local area, we're going to start to really, really reap the bad benefits.
So how can listeners link up with Friends of the Earth then? Support you, even maybe subscribe to your magazine.
Yeah, well, the best thing to do, give our London office a call, because they'll connect you up with exactly the right people. That's 0207 490 155. Our website is www.foe friendsoftheearth.co.uk, or have a look if you're really interested in fracking. Have a look at www.globalfrackdown.org, because this massive day of action on the 22nd of September is going to make international news, and it's going to be a real stand against continual fossil fuels from the big energy companies.
Well, I mean, I don't know what day of the week is that. Do you know?
It says here it's a Saturday.
Yeah. Well, I'll see if I can make it down.
That's really good.
Thank you, David, from David Powell from Bristol Friends of the Earth. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, Monday, this coming Monday, is Hiroshima Day, the one day a year we remember the tens of thousands of Japanese killed by the world's first atomic bomb used against a civilian population. That is opposed to just a test. I'm joined now by local peace campaigner and author of on the subject of depleted uranium, Joanne Baker. But before we hear from Joe, let's go back to the 6th of August, 1945, just after the bomb was dropped on the Japanese civilians of Hiroshima. And here is US President Harry Truman on the radio.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us. It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemy. And we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes.
Well, I certainly have to echo that last sentiment, particularly with all the tensions mounting in the Middle East right now. But anyway, Joanne Baker, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, your book is called Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq Wars. But tell us about Hiroshima Day. What is the point of really remembering this? Because actually, for a lot of people, it's something they want to forget.
Yes, well, I think it's very important to actually remember what happened on that day, and remembering also that the US is the only country to ever actually use these weapons. And I think what we're finding now in these wars, which go on, you know, across country after country, that the three countries which are now using radioactive weapons, which are having really in many ways a very similar effect to Hiroshima, are the US, the UK and Israel. And I've been looking to see what has been happening in Iraq for many years now, and that is probably the place most polluted with this type of radioactivity, especially in certain areas. They're finding in Fallujah now that the rate of cancers and birth deformities is actually far worse than the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it just goes to show how serious this is now becoming.
It certainly is. Now, this stuff, depleted uranium, is basically a byproduct of the manufacturing process to make nuclear fuel rods for our British power stations, basically. And it's a kind of nuclear waste.
It is a nuclear waste, but it's also the type of DU which has gone into weapons has also been mixed with other types of nuclear waste, so it's more dangerous than just the pure DU. And interesting enough, what's happened in the last few years, since 2001, is that scientists have been going out to these countries, to Afghanistan, to Lebanon, to Iraq, taking samples, looking for traces of DU, and they haven't found any. But they are finding they're finding two types. They're finding slightly enriched uranium in these bomb craters, and they're finding what they call undepleted, which isn't natural uranium. It's actually man-made, but it's much closer to natural uranium. So there's a big mystery going on as to actually which weapons are using this, because it's being totally denied by the US.
Now, this is a mystery, isn't it? But I mean, tell us about the effects of this depleted uranium, because it's something that it seems that the military like to use it, but they don't necessarily think, when they're firing these depleted uranium shells, what the after effects are going to be.
No, and I think legally this is quite a big problem, because the governments will say that these are not radioactive weapons because they're not used with the intent of radiating the people in these countries, but actually the effects, and they do know the effects, the effects are having exactly those results.
So what effects are they? What's the actual effect on the population?
Yeah,
I mean, ultimately, I mean, what we're doing effectively is taking our nuclear waste, rather than burying it in somewhere safe, is putting it into a warhead or a shell or something, and then firing it off in some foreign country.
Yeah, it's mainly cancers, immune deficiencies, congenital birth defects in Fallujah now, which is a town in Iraq that was hit very heavily in 2004 by the US. Now 15% of all babies are now born with quite serious birth deformities, and those are the ones recorded. It's probably worse than that, and that's also not counting all the miscarriages, the people who find they can't conceive. So it's actually becoming a huge problem.
Now, I understand there's some sort of sponsor walk going on now. What's that all about?
Yeah, the sponsor walk has already happened, actually.
Sorry, I missed it.
No, but it's a friend of mine in Bristol who did an amazing walk along Hadrian's Wall in the wind and the rain and the mud for 84 miles. And she's been raising money, which will go directly to Dr. Samira Arlani in Fallujah for these children, and she's been sponsored through an organization called Charity Giving, and she has a page on that website which is actually open until the 6th of August, which is why I'm mentioning it now.
Okay,
so anybody who would like to give money towards that is still open this weekend.
And what would you suggest for anyone in the city that's interested in anti-nuclear campaigning? Are there any groups in the city that take this issue seriously now, or this long time, whatever it is, 60 years or so after Hiroshima?
Yeah, there's Southwest Against Nuclear, which is working very hard to stop the new build at Hinkley C. And they're having a mass trespass in October. I think it's between October the 5th and the 9th. I think those are the dates. So
okay.
It's worth getting hold of them. Yeah.
Right, lovely, Joe. Well, thanks ever so much for coming in, and let's hope that we don't forget this whole Hiroshima business, because although it's something that's a little bit nasty to think about, it's really important that we learn the lessons from there. The interesting thing, one of the things, of course, that Harry Truman said there was that it was a military target on the same day. Of course, it's not a military target at all. He lied. The very first day he talked about it, it's a civilian target. So thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now I'm joined from the London-based campaign Reinvestigate 9/11 by Fran Anderson. Hi Fran, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi there, Tony.
Well, first of all, we've had the death of Gore Vidal this week, so let's just have a quick listen to him talking about the post 9/11 world in America and his book Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace.
I'll plug a book, not my own, which I've been reading in the car coming down here. It's called The New Pearl Harbor: Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. It's by David Ray Griffin, foreword by Richard Falk. It's very thorough. It's not a hectic prose. Fingers are pointed. A lot of it is questions that never got answered. For instance, one of the questions which I asked first in Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. The law is that if a plane has been hijacked within something like 6-7 minutes, fighter planes are scrambled. That's sent aloft to investigate, to get the plane to come back to Earth, get it to return to where it came from, or if necessary, shoot it down. The planes never went off in the 2 hours that they knew from the first hijacking until the very last one. Anyway, I recommend this book. It's very disturbing because you realize that there's a lot of menace around, and that since we don't have a free press or media, since it all belongs to the same sort of people who benefit from these wars and pay for the people who are in Congress, White House, we have no redress. We have no place to turn, except a kind of samizdat, which we're beginning to develop in the United States, writing for each other, and then information begins to get around. I went to Moscow a few times before the Soviet Union collapsed, and I was always amazed with all that censorship they had, and Pravda and so on. I said, how is it that most of the Russians that I talk to, intellectuals, know more about what's going on in the world than the average American with our tons and tons of newsprint and TV? Oh, they said, it's a trick.
That's Gore Vidal there. Now, Fran, can you just give us a quick idea of why we have such a campaign called Reinvestigate 9/11?
Well, because, Tony, there's been a lot of unanswered questions concerning the official story, including Thomas Keane and Lee Hamilton, the two co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, have come out in a book in 2007, I think it was, called 9/11, The Inside Story Without Precedent About the 9/11 Commission, where they actually say that they don't understand why they were not told the truth, as the truth was clearly not told to them, particularly about NORAD when some tapes were released in August 2006.
Now, NORAD is the American Air Defence System, isn't it? And that's what Gore Vidal was pointing out there. He was saying, hang on a minute, these planes should have been intercepted. For 2 hours, the fighter jets just sat on the ground and did nothing. Anyway, whereabouts are you, Reinvestigate 9/11 campaign on the web?
We're at www.reinvestigate911.org. And at the moment, we've been having a letter-writing campaign to the BBC Trust complaining about the lack of adequate reporting and unbiased reporting on people who question 9/11 and the official story of 9/11. We've had appalling coverage from BBC Conspiracy Files, which deliberately do not report it in proper depth.
OK, well, that actually compares very well with what Gore Vidal was saying about the American media, saying it's basically controlled by the same people that want the wars in the first place and stand to benefit by events like 9/11. So anyway, brief but fantastic. Thank you very much, Fran, for joining us. That's all the serious talk out of the way now, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live with Spike and Rodsey tonight, covering for Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Noel, Chris Davies, who I'm afraid didn't turn up. We had an empty chair, but we do thank you. Patient advocate Daphne Havercroft, David Powell from Friends of the Earth, anti-nuclear author Joe Baker, and Fran Anderson from Reinvestigate 9/11. Also, of course, Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cats Alliance. Next week, if you've not been to the old South Bristol College site on Marksbury Road in Bedminster, are the officers at Bristol City Council Property Services working in the interests of Bristol people, or they have other agendas for the site? Music this week is from late 1990s.